It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel, KLRB, Carmel, California, Dialogue Conspiracy. This is number 220, and it's a beautiful, sunny June 7th, 1976. Beautiful day in Carmel, California. I am going to talk, for the most part, about elections and the electoral process. The primaries are tomorrow here in California, but then you will be getting this tape later in other cities, but what I have to say will apply to the November elections or all other elections that follow, because my feelings are pretty general on the subject of American elections. Before I get into the electoral process and the primaries here, there was an article I saw in this morning's paper I wanted to share with you, not having to do with the primaries, but interesting. I couldn't help reading it to you. It's from the San Jose Mercury, a UPI story. The headline title is "Ban on Cancer-Causing Additives Described as Nonsense by Butts." Agricultural Secretary Earl Butts said Sunday at a lecture in Anaheim that he denounced as utter nonsense a federal law banning cancer-causing additives from food, and he said the poison, properly used, is good for people. That's our Secretary of Agriculture. He then went on to say that if farmers are able to feed the world's growing population, they and food processors will have to make increasing use of chemicals, including some that will be poisonous and dangerous and capable of causing cancer if they're given in massive doses to laboratory animals. I think it is good for some people. I guess I agree with him that poison properly used is good for some people, but it depends who's giving the poison and who they're using it on, and we all don't get a choice of who we can give it to. So I just thought I'd pass that along for whatever it's worth. Also, I want to mention a new book on conspiracies, which came to me at KLRB last week from Penn Jones in Texas. There are many good books coming out about the John Kennedy assassination, and this is the latest, and it is a good book. It's called Cover Up, and the address is P.O. Box 722, Claiborne, Texas, C-L-E-B-U-R-N-E, Texas 76031. The price is $10.95. It's quite expensive, but it's an excellent book. It's written by J. Gary Shaw and Larry Harris, and it seems to be one of the best books that I've seen about the shooting in Dealey Plaza that killed John Kennedy. If I read that address too fast, you can call me or send a postcard to the station or contact me later, and I'll get the address to you. Cover Up, P.O. Box 722, Claiborne, C-L-E-B-U-R-N-E, Texas 76031. I do recommend it because it is an excellent book. Well, tomorrow in California are our primaries, and as I say, some stations will have had, the primaries will be over by this time they receive these tapes. But primaries are important. The elections are important since 1960. They've interested me. I went to the Coliseum in Los Angeles to hear the acceptance speech of John Kennedy and took my family there to hear him speak. And since that last election in 1960, every election's been affected by bullets or blackmails. Blackmail, that quotation that I started after the Watergate affair when I wrote my first published article, has been used by many people since. But assassinations, murders, near murders, and a drowning, and the blackmails have accompanied every election since 1960. The 1976 elections already had what I call the counterintelligence shenanigans of Squeaky Fromm and Sarah Jane Moore. I don't believe the secret team, the same team that killed John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King or shot George Wallace, did intend to kill Gerald Ford in California these two occasions. When the secret team moves, they move to kill. They use crossfires, they use silencers, they use several weapons, and they do not miss. If you heard the news tonight, came over the news on KLRB during the day about new Freedom of Information Act and information about the crossfire in the Ambassador Hotel, the 12 or 13 bullets that were there the night Robert Kennedy was killed. Sources from higher up, more authoritative sources, are beginning to admit what we researchers have known almost from the evening that Robert Kennedy was killed. All of these murders had one gun and weapons with silencers. That's the only way you could get 13 bullets shot in the Ambassador Hotel, would be one gun with silencers and a crossfire. The blackmail of candidates has gone on during elections every year, and this year we have a nice open sex scandal in an orgy room. And I guess this is going to stay with us for a long time to come, and from now on, each person will be vulnerable, and every woman will write her book, and maybe the congressman will shape up and not be running the country by blackmail, because so long as this is going on, there's nothing wrong with their sex habit. But in this case, they use the women to control the votes. They're taken into what they call the education room, the Sam Rayburn room off of Carl Albert's office, and then they bring these people back into the Congress and win deciding votes, I guess, depending on the kind of sex trip they had. Incidentally, when I talk about crossfires and silencers, you haven't heard anything about two men that were indicted and were on $100,000 bail up in Sacramento when Gerald Ford was there and Squeaky Fromm was holding a weapon. On October the 21st, 1975, two men were indicted in Los Angeles. They'd been arrested in Santa Barbara. They were on their way to Sacramento. They had plans for a sewer system, and they were going to use a rifle. There's no mention of silencers, but when there's a backup team that could have killed Gerald Ford there in Sacramento, the case is hushed up, and although I take 8 papers a day and get information from many papers, I haven't heard a thing about this case. The indictment was in October. It hasn't gone to trial, evidently, and $100,000 bail is a lot of bail to keep two unknown people locked up all this time, and there's dead silence. So this could have been the backup team that would have done it to Gerald Ford in Sacramento. It was on the eve of his California primary 8 years ago this June that Robert Kennedy was killed. And it was on the eve of his Maryland-Michigan victory that George Wallace was left crippled and unable to run the 72 elections. So those primaries were affected, and the outcome of the election was affected by these accidents with the bullet. May 28, 1968, Rose Kennedy was campaigning in Monterey, California, at the Mark Thomas Hotel. And I've mentioned this before on some programs, how I placed a letter in her hand telling her that there was no way that Robert Kennedy could go past that primary and become President of the United States unless he opened up very swiftly and immediately the assassination of his brother, John Kennedy. If the same people from the FBI and CIA and White House planned the killing of the President of the United States, there's no way that they would let Senator Robert Kennedy be president. And those same people are still in power today, have more power than ever because they've allowed the layers of cover-up to keep over them all of this time. Robert Kennedy died 5 days after I had seen Rose Kennedy and in the eve of his primary. A few years later, Ted Chirac surfaced. I didn't know him at the time, but he became quite visible. He made a movie called The Second Gun. He's the one person who must be terribly pleased about the news and documentation and confirmation of those 12 to 13 bullets in the Ambassador Hotel, because he claimed all along that the evidence was there that a second gun was shot. The autopsy report indicated the gun was held an inch from the back of Robert Kennedy's head. A security guard was standing there. The security guard was a known racist. He even said in the movie The Second Gun that the Kennedys were giving the country to the niggers. He was a bodyguard from a security service, and the new report of Senator Church on intelligence talks about the CIA having private security guard agencies, so it would be interesting to look back and see the links of a service, if there are any, to the intelligence community. Caesar worked full-time during the day at Lockheed Aircraft as a maintenance man, which later, by translation, was a plumber, and in the intelligence circles is known as a man who fixes things up. The killing of President Kennedy in 1963 altered that election, the foreign and domestic policies of the United States for the next 13 years. The point being, you can work your energy off and listen to these commercials and go through your ballots and carefully study every issue and every candidate and weigh his good and bad and his domestic policy and his foreign policy, both now and in November, up to November. You can take your energies and analyze and educate yourselves. But the fact is that when a person is slain and assassinated, and if you voted for him, you have then lost the election. All your wishes go down the drain, and your vote is literally for nothing. The only way your vote would count would be if the vice president had the same policies as the man you elected. And in this election, not one man has stated who he would appoint for vice president, so we don't know who we'd get, even if we go to the bother of voting. That doesn't mean you shouldn't vote. What I'm trying to say is that you should demand an opening of the investigations of the past murders to make sure that the man you elect in can stay in and stay alive, and there's no way that you have of knowing he'll stay alive unless you check into these things. Harlan Cleveland visited the Monterey Peninsula this week. In case you don't know his name, he's now Dr. Cleveland. He got an honorary degree at the Monterey Institute of Foreign Studies here in my hometown. I attended the ceremony. My son graduated there. Dr. Cleveland was formerly president of the University of Hawaii. He had a long list of credentials from the Defense Department, from NATO, and various government agencies. And he's presently working in Aspen, Colorado on international affairs and advising Mr. Jimmy Carter on foreign affairs. Given Cleveland's background and with Washington and Defense Department and military decisions in the United States and the conservatism of the institution that invited him, I took one long deep breath and thought I'd just sleep that one through and was pleasantly surprised. First, Mr. Cleveland ran down his trips to four continents that he just left: New Zealand, Australia, France, Japan, and Africa. He listed at the graduation ceremonies all the national, international complaints about the United States wherever he goes, overseas or at home, what we've done to other countries, our exploitation, imperialism, distrust, suspicions, buying off politicians, secrecy, the president leaving out office in disgrace. And he enumerated, and you all know, the opinion many people have of the country at this low point. He then went on to explain that all these negative feelings about the United States as a nation originated exactly 12 years ago, going back to November 22, 1963, when John Kennedy was murdered, and then the three assassinations that followed afterwards. The other assassinations, there also was Malcolm X. He implied through interviews and written literature and conversation that in those days other countries trusted us. They had hope, which they don't have now. They thought they could recover from the war years and the Cold War years. They believed in us. They believed they could be like us. They believed they could grow and develop. And that ended abruptly with one bullet at that period of time. And the elections of 1960 then were null and void. We went into a bloody war that escalated 2 days after John Kennedy was killed. We've now put in 77 military dictatorships. We've imported the Korean CIA gunpowder manufacturer, Reverend Sun Moon, to take our youth away from us. And we have put in instruments of torture trained by Americans in Brazil, Chile, Argentina, South Korea, with death squads in many, many countries over the world. So I say again, a few well-placed bullets, particularly that one that blew John Kennedy's head off. All that changed American policy and every vote that voted for him. And I appreciated what Mr. Cleveland was saying. And I think when we look back, we'll realize we not only have to work hard for who is elected into office, but we have to demand a set of guidelines about keeping them alive and investigating properly and immediately when the next assassination takes place. And there are methods of doing that. You can worry about who is president, go to your polls, but remember that so long as you don't push for a total, unlimited investigation of the past murders, it doesn't matter who you vote for, because it can be over in any moment. And also remember that the agencies that you pay your money to, your taxes to investigate these murders, the local police, the FBI, the CIA, have within them special investigating teams that cover up the real motive for the murder, which is specifically to alter the policies of the person you have voted for. And when that person is assassinated or injured or blackmailed, those federal agencies have cooperated in making sure that a new policy takes an effect. If the old policy and the new policy were the same, there'd be no reason to have a murder. So what you have is a change of domestic and overseas foreign policy when a particular person is murdered or removed from office by blackmail. And not every employee of these departments is responsible for the cover-up. The reason researchers can do as much mileage as we have done is because there are some honest people inside the FBI and the police departments who make honest reports, autopsy reports, that have discrepancies to the CIA and FBI reports. There are some honest agents, that policemen, that turn in information and documentation that does not match the elite squad that is responsible for the investigations. And it's through these people that we get an education that there's two stories to these shootings, and it's these two stories that make the researchers keep working harder and moving along to investigate how these murders really took place. Now, there is a article that I read at length this week. I want to share it with you because it's terribly important, and what it has in it is the nucleus for one more presidential assassination for sure, if not a congressman or a senator, assemblyman. It has all the ingredients, if you were to bake a recipe for an assassination, and besides the suppression of the story, which is the first ingredient, because it's a grisly story and it's complicated. And I'm going to try and go down the line with you in detail and show you the exact ingredients it takes for one more political assassination of a political figure. And for those of you who want to get the article and cross-file it and read it carefully, it's still in your libraries. It's an article, Los Angeles Times, by John Hurst, dated May 31st, 1976. It was just this last week. And the title of the article, the lead title, is Murders Raise Questions About Officers' Conduct. And I'm always interested in police officers, and particularly Los Angeles Police Department officers, because they've had a murder incorporated identical to the death squads in Brazil and Argentina and Chile for quite a few years now, and they have literally gotten away, bad joke, with murder. This article has the earmarks, as I say, of an assassination team. And what's important is that the trial of three men just took place in San Bernardino County involving a double murder. And if any of you listening to the show have seen newspaper articles other than the one I'm mentioning on this subject, please send them to me, because I consider myself pretty well read, and this did not catch my eye until just this week. And considering it was the longest trial in the entire San Bernardino County's history, it was completely blacked out by the news media, as was the after the arrest of the men in Santa Barbara the same day that Squeaky Frome was arrested. But this was a case where two people were mutilated, cut up, napalm thrown on them, left out in the desert. And I'll give you the ingredients of this case. It involves the CIA. It involves a Russian weapon that would disguise a CIA weapon. It involves members of the Los Angeles Police Department, machine guns and other guns with silencers, and furthermore, it involves ammunition supplied by the Secret Service agent and a man whose position included the protection of the President of the United States. Three men, briefly, Richard Waisman, W-A-I-S-S-M-A-N, Donald Blansett, B-L-A-N-S-E-T-T, and Luke Austin, were convicted this last week of murdering a gentleman named John Gressman, G-R-E-S-S-M-A-N, and Russell Olsey, O-L-S-E-Y. Now, Waisman and Blansett were security guards at the Playgirl nightclub out in Orange County in Anaheim, and Luke Austin has been in the Marines for over 20 years. The teamwork, Mr. Waisman and Blansett were busy shooting revolvers and machine guns with silencers. They would go out to the Mojave Desert and shoot guns with silencers. And the man that was killed, a Mr. Gressman, a security guard for the nightclub, one of the first one that was killed, called or informed Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and told the agencies that members of the Los Angeles Police Department and Highway Patrol, specifically nine members of the Highway Patrol, and a member of the Los Angeles Police Department were wanting weapons with silencers. And he knew how to make them, but he knew it was illegal. And he told Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, a branch of our Secret Service, that they were coming to him, Highway Patrol people, with silencers, and they wanted to practice out in the desert. Now, the agents of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, two of the agents, their names are Richard Newby and William Curley, were notified by this Mr. Gressman. So they advised him to go ahead, take them out to the desert, take pictures, and the gentleman who was working with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, a husband, five children, married, took them out and gathered the evidence for ATF for an arrest. Whereupon the agents of the federal government notified the people who were doing the shooting, the illegal shooting, the highway patrolman and the member from the Los Angeles Police Department. And Mr. Gressman had told his attorney he was very nervous about taking these people and he was afraid that he'd be arrested shooting out there with these illegal arms, firearms. So he notified his attorney that if anything happened to him, there was a tape recording in his garage in the basement and to use it in case he was arrested or anything happened, if he was busted, that the story and the telephone conversations and the deal was in his garage. The federal agents, instead of arresting highway patrolmen, as I said, and they had photographs of an officer from the Los Angeles Police Department who later moved up and was rewarded, I'll go into that, Reginald Wells, they had movies of him. The ATF notified the police agents that Gressman was an informer on them and that they would lose their jobs with the Highway Patrol and with the LAPD. So September the 5th, 1972, they took Mr. Gressman, shot him in the face and blasted his face and hands off, poured napalm over his body and buried him out in the desert. And this was after the agents had told the officers that this particular person was informing them. And after he was killed, and the same day he was killed, one of the men called a highway patrolman who was involved in the case and said to him, "You don't have to worry about him anymore. We're going to take care of him." And they knew he was going to be murdered, and they took no action before or after the informant was slain. The officer from the Los Angeles Police Department, named Mr. Pearson, was called, and he was told by these people, "You don't have to worry anymore. We're going to take care of them." And that meant that the highway patrolman, the LAPD, would be cleared, and they wouldn't have to worry about the informant, even though he was working for the federal government and allegedly believed that he was patriotic and doing a favor. Now, the Orange County Sheriff's Department, an agent from the Sheriff's Department, was fired from the force because he had given out unauthorized information regarding the murder case. This is identical to the Manson family out at Spahn Ranch, where the sheriffs were ordered, "Don't stop Manson from using machine guns or firing. Don't bother him. Don't arrest him." They knew they had chicks. They knew they had drugs. This was an identical situation. The one Orange County sheriff's deputy who had information and was giving out information about the murder case of Mr. Gressman was fired from the case, and everything was hushed up about this particular case until 4 years later. And just hushed up until this last week in the Los Angeles Times, that there were CIA weapons that were given to these men, ammunition from the Secret Service, member of the LAPD, and highway patrol officers. Now the question is, was this sheriff's deputy fired because these men were a select team that could be used for an assassination and he was blowing the cover? Because all of these people involved sailed through any investigation and were not even suspect. The attorney for Mr. Gressman took the tape recordings from the basement floor, from the garage floor, gave them to the police. The police wasn't interested. They did nothing about it. They said, "There's no body. We can't find him." And they dropped the entire case, and it rested for 2 years until another security guard from the same club was murdered. His name was Norman Olson. And it wasn't the police again who broke the story. It was the same club. It was the same job. And another guy was shot, his face blown away, his hands cut off, body mutilated. And these were men who were working with the police department in, all along, and with the ATF who was protecting them. And I'll tell you how they did it a second time. It wasn't the police that broke the second case. It was a female friend of Mr. Olson's who broke the story. Now, after these two murders, Mr. Weissman, who was one of the suspects, he worked at the nightclub as another security guard there. He was another suspect. His name was on the tapes of Mr. Gressman. The highway patrolmen continued their cozy relationship by using an agent who was in contact with Mr. Weissman, even though he was a suspect in his case. Two murders had taken place. A man by the name of Mr. Carter. Now, Carter was selling these people. They were using silencers with machine guns out in the desert, and Mr. Carter was selling them U.S. Secret Service ammunition to Mr. Weissman, according to the San Bernardino County Deputy District Attorney Arden. And the ammunition was made especially for Secret Service and other federal agents under the Treasury Department. This is interesting because Martin Luther King was murdered by a dum-dum bullet, a kind that shattered completely. It was a special kind of a bullet. And Donald DeFries was shot by a special gun and a special bullet by an agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigations, allegedly a Donald Gray, nephew of Pat Gray, who has not been taken to any grand jury or asked about that particular shooting. Now, these bullets are specially loaded and stamped. They're not available commercially, so the link of the Secret Service to the rifle practice is very firm, and the Secret Service agents told the Los Angeles Times of the special .38 caliber ammunition spotted by these agents, and they were selling them at various places at gun collectors' shows. Fred Nagel, a Secret Service agent who occasionally guarded the president. You see how casual this is? The Los Angeles Times says Nagel occasionally guarded the president. Well, how often do you have to guard him? It's like with Robert Kennedy. One time, Thane Caesar was a security guard, and a Mr. Lawson guarded John Kennedy one time when he went to Dallas. He was the first time he was in charge of the security for a large kind of an operation like that, and he went to internal security and in 10 minutes was told that there was no danger in Dallas. Later we learned out that they had almost a million names on the list across the country, and many from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But the LA Times very casually said that Fred Nagel, a Secret Service agent who occasionally guarded the President of the United States, was suspended only last week as a result of an investigation into missing ammunition. Nagel, the Secret Service agent, said he is a friend of and a shooting companion of Carter, one of the men who kept close contact with Mr. Weissman, and he also was in charge of all the ammunition for the Los Angeles area of the Secret Service. They used a CIA gun. What they did was they used a gun from the Central Intelligence Agency, one or more, and they also used a Russian gun, an unmarked Russian gun, which would conceal, like we hear from the terrorists, they could blame the Russians or the terrorists for importing the weapon. I'm looking here through my papers because I had a name of the gun. You know, they could use a CIA weapon to do the killing and then have a Russian gun to leave by the side of the body and link it to the killing. They went to that trouble to make sure that they had this Russian gun with them at the time, and it would be very conveniently deposited, because if you've been reading about these arsenals of terrorists taking these guns away, it was a .22 that they were practicing with out in the Mojave Desert and with machine guns, and then they used Russian weapons, .47 automatic, which doesn't mean much to me, but it would to a gun collector, with ammunition provided by the Secret Service agent, the man in the position to protect the president. Now, the investigation still went slowly about these two mutilations and these two murders because the brother of Mr. Blancett, one of the suspects, works as a deputy in Orange County Sheriff's Department. And he kept telling Mr. Blancett what information was coming in and about the investigation. And he saw the file in the sheriff's office. And the conclusion was, after this large investigation, they had two murders, two mutilations, and the same persons were suspects, and one even had a tape recording from 2 years before naming the suspects, and the Orange County investigators wouldn't do anything about it, and the brother of one of the suspects worked as a deputy in the sheriff's department. But the consensus of the investigators who finally got the charges on these men said, you couldn't trust law enforcement agencies in Orange County. We don't know if they were direct informants to the defendants. Now, that is a very serious statement to make by persons, it was in the Los Angeles Times, by persons involved in the case, because Mr. Blancett, one of the suspects, did have a brother working there. The alcohol, tobacco, and firearms did tip off the policemen and the highway patrolmen who were doing the wrong thing. In February 1976, this was just a few months ago, Weissman and Blancett were convicted for first-degree murder in the death of Mr. Gressman and Mr. Olsey, and given life imprisonment. As I say, it was the longest trial in San Bernardino County. And now what has happened to those people that were involved in setting up these two murders of giving them that information? Highway Patrolman Pearson is now working in Bay City, Michigan, and hopes to get back on the police force. He left town he was informed that day that Mr. Grossman was going to get it. They didn't have to worry about him anymore. He dropped his job and went back east that same day, retired from the Highway Patrol, went back east to Bay City, Michigan, where he's been. He hasn't been charged with cover-up, even though he knew it was going to happen. And after it happened, didn't help the authorities. He was very much part of this operation. Highway Patrolman Dennis Carter and Richard Chambers were fired temporarily from the police force, and they're appealing their dismissal in court. They were shooting illegal machine guns and silencers, and they were the two men responsible for tipping off and making the murders possible, and they're appealing their dismissal. The other highway patrolmen, their names are Peters, Fellows, Pollock, Shelton, Tim, Spring, were fired temporarily. They were charged with using illegal weapons. They were rehired again by the Highway Patrol. They received all their back pay, all but 30 days and of 3.5 months off, and they're your friendly Highway Patrol in California, down in Anaheim or wherever the Highway Patrolmen wander. They're out on the road again, so if you remember the names, you may look at some time, and I read them pretty fast. I hope you don't remember them, because you'll have bad feelings if you see them. LAPD Officer Reginald Weld, who was photographed, Wells, W-E-L-L-S, photographed shooting illegal machine guns with silencers, is now in the Wilshire Division, a choice division, which I think does include the Wilshire Division, the Ambassador Hotel, where Robert Kennedy was killed. He has been given a good assignment with bonus pay for the Los Angeles Police Department. He's there in full force. The investigators, William Johnson from Orange County Sheriff's Department, who, in the process of investigating the murders, used people that were suspects in the murders, is still working as investigator for the Orange County Sheriff's Department. Richard Blanson from Orange County Sheriff's Department is appealing his dismissal. He's the brother of one of the men that was charged, and he's appealing. He wants to be back. Mr. Grossman's widow is suing the federal, state, and Orange County for $6.5 million because alcohol, tobacco, and firearms exposed his danger and told the men that he was becoming an informer, and because agents of the Highway Patrol did not warn him that his death was coming that day or try to reach him. They had advance warning, and then after he was murdered, they didn't help solve the crime and allowed suspects of the murder, even mentioned in tapes, to continue the investigation, and Orange County covered it up completely. So she's suing them for $6.5 million. And alcohol, tobacco, and firearms promoted their agents, Richard Newby and William Curley, have been promoted. They did a good job, even though they were the ones that tipped off the highway patrolman of this incident. Now, what does this add up to at a time of primaries or elections or the futility of elections or the manipulation of bodies? You have here in this one article, which came, as I say, in the Los Angeles Times, May 31st, 1976, the duplication and the potential of assassination teams, which I have noticed through my research of all the other major assassinations. And the minors and the majors and everyone's equal, but I mean the ones that really affect history. We all affect history. Medgar Evers is as important as Martin Luther King. Each one of them is important. But what you get here is the protection of the judges, the investigators, the news media, entire news blackout all this time that was going on, and even now, just one article from all the newspapers I get, even LA Free Press or Vanguard, Berkeley Barb, I haven't seen anything. There's been a total news black on this horrendous case. You get a situation where all the persons involved were protected and also promoted with nothing happening to them. The overwhelming case against the particular men that were charged with the murders was just too much. They're in jail now, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're out in 2 or 3 years on good behavior or teaching sensitivity training or finding Christ, like Charles Tex Watson is doing, who did the 7 murders, Sharon Tate and LaBianca's and the others in that house. He's quite a religious organizer, written up in some Christian magazines coming out of Texas, I saw this week, and he'll be out of jail before too long, and Charles Manson will never get out. And I imagine these men working with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, and with a Secret Service agent who has a role so high he protects the president, And being anonymous, totally anonymous, you don't know their names, you probably never heard of them until today. So they'll slip out of jail like that acid killer that was sent to Taiwan, and they'll be out shortly because they work with these teams and because of this terrible news blackout. These two heinous murders took place because one man was working for the federal government. Again, a patsy wiped out, trying to seize law enforcement officials with illegal machine guns and silencers. We have weapons supplied by the Central Intelligence Agency. That was part of the article. You have your weapons, your Russian weapon there, ready to blame outside forces if it's found at the scene of the crime, which continues to keep the Cold War going and confuse the motives of who was behind it. Just like we had links of Oswald and Sirhan Sirhan and James Earl Ray or Arthur Bremer to the leftists through literature and planted diaries. You have this Russian gun that they're also using that they can shoot with the CIA gun that's the silencer and then leave the Russian gun. And the motives, again, get confused on why our leaders are being killed. You have the relatives of one of the murderers working with law enforcement, which was typical in all these cases, brothers. I can do one show just on brothers. Political patsies and assassins, and in this case you have a relative working with law enforcement. You have members of the vigilante. These members were part of the vigilante team down in Orange County, very adept with weapons and silencers, who are looking forward to taking the law into their own hands. We have the Secret Service agent, a man who sometimes provided security for the President of the United States, keeping this kind of party and providing ammunition for this motley crew. You get alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, the same agency that was named in tape recordings by Larry Shears that was offering him to make a deal to kill Eldridge Cleaver or to kill Cesar Chavez. And that was blown, that cover was blown, and there were tape cassettes available. I have a tape of it. I've had it for quite a few years, and so those men are still alive because that cover was blown. But you have alcohol, tobacco, and firearms one more time, tipping off your illegal police and allowing their informant to be murdered so that the policemen don't get in trouble. The policemen have to be protected. Then you have the police, after the murders, coming into the house where tape recorders existed, refusing to fingerprint the cottage, refusing to investigate. Even though the victim feared for his life, left a tape recording, named the people, the police refused to do anything. They didn't do anything at all, and it was only a woman who broke the case when the second guard was murdered, who happened to be a friend of hers, and she knew about it. Well, so much for that. I think you can let that sink in and get the idea that assassination teams are available. This is the way they work. This is the chain of command. The law enforcement, and I think I've made it pretty clear that that's how they get away with it. That's the way you get crossfires in Dealey Plaza or the Lorraine Motel, outside the Lorraine Motel, or the Ambassador Hotel, or Laurel Shopping Center in Maryland. You get your silencers, you get your weapons confused, you get your police covering it up, and your motives confused. The investigator's not doing the job, even though there's massive evidence. And then the course of history is altered. That's the syndrome we have to talk about sometime and break that. Just in the time we have left, we have another problem at another level, and that's our congressional districts. We have primaries coming up tomorrow in our area of Leon Panetta, John Bacalian, and Bert Talcott. And what I want to talk about is not who to vote for these three men. I want you to think about it, but I want to talk about the honesty and funding and where these people come from, and this is an important issue, and you have to think about in November elections. You don't have time to do your homework between now and tomorrow, but between now and November, by the Freedom of Information Act, you can ask the men where they get their funding from, or the women if they run for office. Leon Panetta in our area is sort of a John Connally who switched from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party in 1972. That's not good enough for me by any stretch of the imagination, because Richard Nixon carefully screened people before he appointed them, and he did appoint Panetta to a position, and he jumped a sinking ship and came. He lives in Monterey and came to the mind that he wanted to represent the Democratic Party, and I feel that there are enough Democrats in this area that have been long, hard Democrats, which without a Nixon Republican to sink the Democratic ship any further, and that's how I feel about that. But I do want to talk about Mr. Talcott, because John Bacalian was kind enough to provide me with information. which Bert Talcott had, which is a symptom of congressional representation, and it explains why you have a bunch of eunuchs back there who don't represent you, because we don't know where their money comes from. And Watergate was a perfect example of that. I have a list of dummy fronts that Robert Mullen carried with Howard Hughes' money, allegedly $10 million in the last elections, names such as the Association for Sensible Disarmament, Organization of Modern Americans, American Citizens for Greater Stability, Association of Neighborhood Volunteers. I have a list of about, I brought 30 in here, about 200 dummy front organizations that are Gulf oil money and milk money and Howard Hughes money, and they have no origin except going back to those corporations, and they're still working. Well, it's very interesting. Mr. Talcott represents our 16th district, which is primarily military and agriculture, largest farm area, lettuce growers in the world, and a large military area. But we have no medical school here. We have no dental school here. So I'm always interested who's funding our candidates. You'll have to investigate yours, because here are some kinds of funding that went to Bert Talcott. And this isn't anything personal against Bert Talcott. This is typical. On his campaign listing this year, he's got the California Dental Political Action Committee from Sacramento, $3,000. Now, what has Sacramento got to do with the 16th District of Monterey, San Luis Obispo, Santa Cruz? He's got the California Medical Political Action Committee from another group, Dr. James Depuy, $4,000. He's got California Medical Political Action Committee, 731 Market Street, $6,000. I'm watching the Hughes Medical Foundation or the Dental Foundation, and I say, well, why does somebody in San Francisco on Market Street, 842 Market Street, Sunset Action Committee, give Bert Talcott $500? Or we have the Business Industry Political Action Committee from Pennsylvania Avenue, $1,000. What interests would they have? What are they doing for us here in Monterey? The Conservative Victory Fund from Washington, D.C., $1,000. The Harry Gray, President United Aircraft, $1,000 from Connecticut. As I say, the California Medical Political Action Committee, $4,000. San Francisco, out of the city, out of the area. I don't think that people running for Congress, Senate or the House, should be allowed to accept money except for their own district. It's like money from Kansas City and New York coming into California to defeat Proposition 15. I think that money for our congressmen should come from just the area they live in, and everyone who gives them money should explain why they support them, and they may benefit them. If a lettuce grower gives Bert Talcott money as much as the law allows, I can't see any objection to that. If the people working for the farm workers want to support another candidate, well and good, whatever the law allows. But I don't see why Life Underwriters Political Action Committee from Washington, D.C. has any interest in our vote in Monterey Peninsula, or why somebody from the Real Estate Political Action Committee from Los Angeles should give $1,000 for a man representing us in Congress next year. I don't know what these all-in executives from Stanford, Connecticut, another $500. I don't know what this out-of-state, out-of-area money is. And as I say, Bert Talcott isn't the only person who has funding like this, but I think it should end. I think it should end once and for all. I believe that Mr. John Pagalian didn't take any money from out of the state, and out of our area, much less the state. I think he took it from Monterey County, and I believe Mr. Panetta said he took money only from Monterey County. And this is a dismal failure of the electoral process to let medical organizations, why would a medical organization, unless it's a dummy front kind of thing, maybe it's legitimate, maybe this doctor owns property at Pebble Beach and he wants to give money to Bert Talcott, let him write a letter. There was somebody from the Mellon family from Pennsylvania that gave money to Bert Talcott, and I understand they have a house here at Pebble Beach. I don't know if they live here or rent it, but I don't think that money from Washington or Los Angeles or San Francisco or real estate money or insurance money or dental money or medical money or Pacific Lighting money from Los Angeles, I don't know who these people are, but I know that when a congressman or a senator or an assemblyman or a California senator, wherever you live, goes to vote, he has to speak up for those people that put him into office. And if those people don't come from your area, there's no way you can be represented. So your primaries between now and November should demand that you get a list from the Freedom of Information Act of every candidate and scale them down and check out these organizations and see if Watergate is still with us at this level, because I know it's with us at the national level. So we have our elections and we do the best we can. Good luck on your votes, whoever you decide to vote for. I hope they win if you want them to win, but if they are worth anything at all, if they can make this country a little bit better, a little bit richer in spirit and in hope, I guarantee you that they'll be killed, because even though it's gloomy to say it, everyone along the line has been murdered since 1960, and therefore we must vote, but we must also investigate both the political assassinations and who's putting our representatives into office in Sacramento. That's it for today. Happy elections. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.